broken hearts which have been caused by this devastating conflict. Robert Carter, London.
A Turkish court has suspended Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's trial in absentia of 26 Saudi nationalists accused of murdering the man inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The Turkish justice minister said a red notice had been issued for 26 suspects. 20 of them were asked to be extradited to Turkey. However, the court's request was rejected and Saudi Arabia demanded the case be transferred to Riyadh.
Yapılmışsa...
A red notice was issued for 26 suspects and 20 of them were asked to be extradited to Turkey, but all our requests were rejected. Saudi Arabia later demanded the transfer of this case. Now the government recommended the court to close the trial in absentia and transfer the case to Saudi Arabia. However, the trial would continue in Saudi Arabia and Turkey will wait to see convictions and sentences before dropping its own case.
The case will be transferred to Saudi Arabia. However, it is seen by many as if it will be closed. Saudi officials say the case is already closed and those involved were convicted. Khashoggi's fiancée Hatice Cenkiz, however, said she would appeal the decision, speaking to reporters in front of the courthouse.
Turkey is not ruled by a family like in Saudi Arabia. We have a justice system that addresses citizens' grievances. We will appeal the decision in line with our legal system.
Many believe the change in Turkey's stance is due to Ankara's bid to restore its relations with countries in the region.
After 4 years of not reaching its purpose and due to the suspects not being extradited to Turkey, to stand in front of the judge, it seems appropriate for Turkey to transfer the case to Saudi Arabia. However, the timing here serves Turkey for sure. It comes ahead of an expected visit by Turkish president to the kingdom, and as Turkey is restoring its relations with countries in the region such as United Arab Emirates and Israel.
Turkish officials had previously said that Khashoggi, who is a known critic of MBS, was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in an operation approved by highest levels in the kingdom. Khashoggi's trial intensified the friction between Ankara and Riyadh, but it seems President Erdogan is looking for a warm welcome during his upcoming visit to the kingdom. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
The latest voter polls in France have shown an almost total evaporation of a once sizable lead for President Emmanuel Macron. His edge over 2017's far-right runner-up, Marine Le Pen, is now down to just 3 points in a hypothetical second round, making the race a dead heat. France goes to the ballot box for the first round in just a few days on April 10th. Recent missteps by Macron may have alienated a French electorate which featured a 40% undecided rate just last week. Macron is being openly accused of trying to run from his record by hiding behind the unrest in Ukraine. He has refused to join any debate before the second round vote and has barely campaigned in France. With Macron's refusal, there was no typical first round debate between the 11 presidential hopefuls. Instead, every candidate sat down for a highly anticipated televised grilling from journalists, all except Macron. His decision has come under harsh scrutiny as being anti-democratic.
It just shows how much Macron is just like all the other politicians, thinking only of himself. He knows that he did not implement the change that he promised, and that's why he can't face anyone. I may submit a blank ballot or vote for the riskiest candidate. That may be the only way to change things.
Macron, who did not hold his first press conference until more than 2 years into his term, has long been criticized as displaying a monarchical aloofness and an authoritarian style of governance. The election campaign has been dominated by xenophobia, which then created major disinterest and now worries of record abstention. With the left still running in third place, a candidate with many far-right policies seems certain to take office.
J'oserais presque dire que la droite sous différentes formes.
The right wing has been exploded into different sections, and both Macron's section and Le Pen's section are stable. 2017 destroyed the other parties and also the influence of society's intermediaries, such as unions and NGOs. And maybe we'll say later that this was a bad thing, but I'm not really interested in this election until the second round.
The huge recent victory of Le Pen's counterpart in Hungary has many wondering if polls have similarly underestimated the right nationalist candidate in France. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The West has declared the collapse of the Russian economy as its goal over its offensive in Ukraine. Moscow, however, says the sharp rise in prices of fuel, grain and other goods, as well as record inflation, hit unfriendly countries almost harder. In the meantime, Russia is reorienting its economy to new markets, and Iran is one of them. Level of trade between Russia and Iran hit a new record in 2021, surpassing the equivalent of $4 billion, with Russian exports to Iran accounting for more than $3 billion of that figure, and Russian imports reaching $967.3 million, up to 21.4% more than a year earlier. During a meeting between business circles of the two countries, businessmen and economic experts discussed readiness from both sides to increase their trade level.
Under heavy Western sanctions, Iran seeks opportunities in boosting foreign trade with Russia. The share of mutual trade between the Russian Federation and Iran is insignificant, but our responsible persons have a serious determination to increase this share. Our goal is to increase trade with Russia to at least $10 billion. This is in the short term.
Meanwhile, entrepreneurs from both countries say they are looking for opportunities to enter the market of the opposite countries.
We are very interested in increasing trade with Iran because the Republic of Dagestan and Iran are close, both by the Caspian Sea and the land route. Prices for Iranian goods are also very attractive for us.
Russia is a very attractive market for us, and we have been trying to enter it for several years. We want to export dairy products, but there are many issues. Banking and customs relations, obtaining permits for Iranian plants, including veterinary ones. There is a lack of professional advice, which slows down work.
As Western countries are increasing their economic pressure on Russia, the country has focused on rapid import substitution and the markets of other countries that have not imposed sanctions on Moscow. Iran has also announced agreements with Russia on the use of national currencies in trade.
Foreign participants know that Russia can use the experience of countries like Iran to foil Western sanctions. They also say boosting economic partnership between Moscow and Iran will help both countries contain Western pressure. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The latest voter polls in France have shown an almost total evaporation of a once sizable lead for President Emmanuel Macron. His edge over 2017's far-right runner-up, Marine Le Pen, is now down to just 3 points in a hypothetical second round, making the race a dead heat. France goes to the ballot box for the first round in just a few days on April 10th. Recent missteps by Macron may have alienated a French electorate which featured a 40% undecided rate just last week. Macron is being openly accused of trying to run from his record by hiding behind the unrest in Ukraine. He has refused to join any debate before the second round vote and has barely campaigned in France. With Macron's refusal, there was no typical first-round debate between the 11 presidential hopefuls. Instead, every candidate sat down for a highly anticipated televised grilling from journalists, all except Macron. His decision has come under harsh scrutiny as being anti-democratic.
It just shows how much Macron is just like all the other politicians, thinking only of himself. He knows that he did not implement the change that he'd promised, and that's why he can't face anyone. I may submit a blank ballot or vote for the riskiest candidate. That may be the only way to change things.
Macron, who did not hold his first press conference until more than 2 years into his term, has long been criticized as displaying a monarchical aloofness and an authoritarian style of governance. The election campaign has been dominated by xenophobia, which then created major disinterest and now worries of record abstention. With the left still running in third place, a candidate with many far-right policies seems certain to take office.
The right wing has been exploded into different sections, and both Macron's section and Le Pen's section are stable. 2017 destroyed the other parties and also the influence of society's intermediaries, such as unions and NGOs. And maybe we'll say later that this was a bad thing, but I'm not really interested in this election until the second round.
The huge recent victory of Le Pen's counterpart in Hungary has many wondering if polls have similarly underestimated the right nationalist candidate in France. Robin Mazahari, Paris.
South Korea test launched a solid fuel space rocket designed to place a satellite into low orbit for surveillance and reconnaissance of North Korea. The test comes just 1 week after North Korea tested a long-range ICBM, prompting a UN Security Council emergency meeting and more sanctions from the United States. Activists in South Korea argue that the behavior of the U.S.-South Korea alliance and its double standards cause tension.
Now they say a lot about the missiles launched by North Korea, but nobody criticizes South Korea and the U.S. firing ICBMs and various other missiles. I think that the situation on the Korean Peninsula is getting worse because of such a hypocritical attitude.
The U.S. last year agreed to allow South Korea to develop missiles of unlimited range. President-elect Yoon Suk-yeol has said he will strengthen the country's alliance with the U.S. and the missiles Seoul deploys, policies garnering significant support.
The ability to quickly receive various military and security information thanks to satellites will strengthen national defense. The stronger our national defense, the more it might provoke North Korea. But I think that the stronger our power, the more it can contribute to peace.
South Korea's president-elect also advocates the preparation of a preemptive missile attack on North Korea if Pyongyang poses an imminent threat. South Korea appears determined to develop space-based military applications in line with its alliance with the United States. South Korea's Air Force chief is scheduled to travel to the U.S. Space and Missile Command next week and discuss South Korea joining a multilateral space alliance led by Washington. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In the limelight.
Like Trump, Boris Johnson has been specially effective in normalizing the scurrilous and norm-shifting aspects of radical right discourse, says Graham McPhee, author, in an article published under the heading Neoliberalism is Normalizing Extreme Right Discourse in the UK. Stay tuned for more. One of the most familiar tactics of populist demagogues when under pressure is to shift the agenda away from reality and into a fantasy world of accusation, smears, false equivalences, and conspiracy theories. This erodes the boundary between the civil and uncivil, resulting in what scholar Ruth Wodak calls the shameless normalization of far-right discourse and ideas. As Wodak explains, the boundaries of the sayable are shifted, and traditional norms and rules of political culture, of negotiation and deliberation are violated by continuous provocations. Hoping to change the media conversation after a damning report on COVID rule-breaking within his administration, Conservative Prime Minister Boris Johnson swiftly deployed this tactic by smearing his chief parliamentary accuser, Labour Party leader Keir Starmer. The slur centers on the baseless and discredited claim that Starmer had protected from prosecution one of Britain's most notorious paedophile predators, this great celebrity Jimmy Savile. This untruth has its origins in the murky world of far-right conspiracy theory, and its endorsement by the Prime Minister has emboldened extremists. Most damning of all has been the condemnation by Savile's victims, relayed by lawyer Richard Scorer, who represented many of them. I can confirm that these allegations against Sir Keir Starmer are completely unfounded and unjustified, Scorer states unequivocally, adding that weaponizing the victim's suffering to get out of a political hole is disgraceful. Johnson's attempt to defend the false allegations suggests a level of a strategic purpose and political calculation, although he may have miscalculated this time. Polling remains dire, while support for Johnson among conservative legislators is ebbing as key aides resign. The jury is still out, and international events may yet give Johnson a reprieve. But if his premiership eventually crashes and burns, there is a danger that the problems this scandal reveals are personalized and localized. The contemptible nature of the smear and the Johnson's attention-grabbing personality encourage the tendency to see the rot only in this particularly bad apple, and the danger to democracy only in a certain style of political pantomime and a scurrilous discourse. Longer-term tendencies, social and institutional structures, and the cohorts of forerunners, allies, and enablers thereby go unnoticed. Recent political experience in the United States can be illuminating here. To an even greater extent, the oxygen-sucking presence of Donald Trump has focused attention on a single figure as the crux upon which the threat to U.S. democracy depends. But as a number of scholars have noted, the trends leading up to the present are deep-seated and still operative. And the coalitions invested in anti-democratic outcomes are more widespread than any single current or personality. In short, the anti-democratic slate is as much a function of the normal way things have been ticking over for decades as it is of moments of crisis, emergency, or the exceptional. In Britain, while Brexit certainly supercharged an antagonistic nativist politics that normalizes extreme right ideas, this tendency did not begin there. Xenophobic and authoritarian ideas that draw on and feed into the worldview of the radical right have been driving key government initiatives for decades. We'll be right back. In 2012, the Conservative Liberal Democrat Coalition launched its hostile environment policy, a dizzying array of measures explicitly designed to make life so unbearable for undocumented migrants that they would voluntarily choose to leave. These policies culminated in the Windrush scandal, whereby an estimated 15,000 British citizens of Caribbean descent were wrongly classified as illegal immigrants, with devastating consequences. Families were separated, people lost their jobs and homes, and many were detained and threatened with being deported to countries they barely knew. The message being sent appears quite clear. Britain's problems are the result of alien invaders, and those invaders are most likely non-white. And in 2003, the then Labour government launched the Prevent Strategy, a post-9/11 initiative ostensibly aimed at preempting radicalization and preventing homegrown terrorism. Widely perceived as targeting British Muslims as a suspect community, the program has been criticized not only as counterproductive, but also for creating the potential for systematic human rights abuses and an increased risk of discrimination. And there is much more of a similar vein in the pipeline. Legislation currently going through Parliament includes a new borders and nationality bill that breaches international law and which arguably creates a second-class, precarious version of citizenship for those with ties to other countries and unable to claim exclusively British descent. An elections bill on the GDP model imposes new and unnecessary obstacles to voting, which in the judgment of one of the governing party's own members of parliament risks undermining one of the most fundamental rights we have here in the UK to vote freely without restriction. Meanwhile, the new policing and crime bill threatens to significantly erode the right to freedom of assembly and peaceful protest. In each case, the legislation is designed to pick apart the paradigm of universal democratic citizenship, which is meant to be open to all citizens regardless of race, ethnicity, social class, or political affiliation. Instead, they privilege a national population, the supposedly real English people, as opposed to ethnic outsiders and the cultural elites who are said to despise the nation. And it is this long-term build-up of a populist, common-sense nativism that represents the most fundamental mainstreaming of extreme right norms and values. The dynamics driving this longer-term trend are complex, but a clue lies in the fact that its proponents include all the parties involved in government since the turn of the millennium. Labour and Liberal Democrat, as well as Conservative, for example, the origins of the hostile environment policy lie in the anti-immigrant crackdown under the new Labour administration in 2007. This speaks to the larger political shifts associated with the cementing of the neoliberal consensus since 1980s in Britain and globally. Neoliberalism, the ideology of privatization, financialization, and labor precarity, not only generates record levels of income and wealth inequality, but also leaves an ideological vacuum by jettisoning the element of redistribution once central to social democratic policies. As political philosopher Nancy Fraser has argued, the easiest way to compensate for this absence is to stress the elements of recognition in politics those culturally defined makers of esteem, status, and identity. And because extreme right ideas focus on the identity of majority of demographics through populist nationalism and resentment at perceived cultural disesteem, neoliberal politics finds a particular affinity there. According to Fraser, this affinity has been particularly strengthened in the UK and the US because under Tony Blair's New Labour and Bill Clinton's New Democrats, neoliberal economics was initially associated with a progressive model of recognition, the discourses of multiculturalism and gender equality that are now pilloried as politically correct or woke. Successful at the time, the center-left has bequeathed a legacy that for many seems to combine the worst of both worlds. While presiding over the collapse of secure employment, these administrations were perceived as sneering at the cultural norms and traditional values of the working class and the blue-collar middle class. For this reason, although governments of every stripe have implemented neoliberalism, it is the center-left that is perceived to have sided with the elites and betrayed ordinary people. After 9/11, New Labour in the UK jettisoned its commitment to multiculturalism and cultural cosmopolitanism, adopting a nativist rhetoric that even the Conservatives denounced as borrowing from the extreme right. But without a different model of economic distribution, a real shift away from neoliberalism and a return to a revived social democracy, all that has been achieved is an even deeper normalization of extreme right discourse. And it is this tendency that subsequent conservative-led governments have pursued with relish. Like Trump, Boris Johnson has been especially effective in normalizing the scurrilous and norm-shifting aspects of radical right discourse. But the deeper threats to UK democracy, just as in the United States, will still need to be addressed once these divisive figures are gone.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This one lay. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Three Israelis to have been killed and eight others wounded during a Palestinian shooting operation in the heart of Tel Aviv, the fourth such operation over the past 3 weeks. And today, another Palestinian shot dead by Israeli forces at the Jenin refugee camp north of the occupied West Bank. Why has there been such an increase in violence in the occupied territories? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether Palestinians carrying out resistance operations in Tel Aviv shows the weakness of Israel's security apparatus while demonstrating that Palestinians are fed up with Israeli violations of their basic human rights. First, let's get a wrap-up of what has occurred in the past days. Mona Kandil is our correspondent, joining us from occupied Ramallah. Well, lots to have happened, unfortunately, to have led to some deaths here. Give us the overview of the incidents, Mona, if you can.
Well, we have to mention why, in the first place, Israeli forces raided the Jenin refugee camp today. The Israeli military stormed the refugee camp of Jenin in order to arrest the father of Raad Hazen, this Palestinian who carried out a shooting operation in Tel Aviv on Thursday, and he was killed by the Israelis Saturday morning. Of course, this operation led to the killing of three Israelis, and he wounded nine others. The Israeli forces raided Jenin in order to arrest the father of Raad Hazen and his brothers. They surrounded Hazen's home, and the Israeli intelligence phoned his father and ordered him in order to hand his sons and himself to the Israeli forces, but he refused. He said, if you want me, you come and take me. I will not surrender. This operation, the clashes took place between Palestinians and Jenin refugee camp and Israeli forces. This led to the killing of one Palestinian, Ahmed Saadi. The jihad movement said he was one of the members of the armed wing of the jihad movement, Saraya al-Quds, and 13 others were wounded, according to Palestinian paramedics. However, the Israeli military said the operation in Jenin didn't end. They will storm Jenin refugee camp again and again. However, the Israeli cabinet decided to impose new sanctions on Jenin. First, the closure of Ashanami, a checkpoint between Jenin and the lands occupied in 1948. Palestinians living in the lands in 1948 are not allowed to enter Jenin. Anyone from Jenin who have relatives.
Quickly, if you can, because we want to get to the guests. Mona, we understand that Israel has given its security forces carte blanche, that they can do whatever they want in a matter of speaking. I want to find out from you if that's true, because many have said that that gives them the right, in their eyes, for executions if they wanted to, which was cited in one of the deaths.
Of course, this is right, because the operation that was that had taken place in Tel Aviv was really painful for the Israelis, and they didn't expect it. So they gave a green light for the forces to do whatever necessary.
Thank you for that. Our correspondent, Mona Kandil from occupied Ramallah. Let me introduce our guests for this edition of the Spotlight. Palestinian scientist and author Mazen Kumsaya joins us from Bethlehem. Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nim, joins us from occupied Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Mazen Qumsaya, let me first start with you. We're looking at, obviously, an increase in the number of deaths. I can give you a wrap-up of that, but I'm sure that you have a sense of what has happened here, particularly the one that happened in busy Tel Aviv street. Tell us your assessment of what is going on here and, of course, how it is that you're having resistance fighters be able to carry out an operation right in the streets of Tel Aviv.
Well, this is a natural response to Israeli continued violations of human rights of Palestinians, ethnic cleansing that's happening in Jerusalem, denying of thousands and thousands of Palestinians access to the Holy City, authorizing settlers to go into the Al-Aqsa Mosque area even during the holy month of Ramadan. And I could go on and on, but there is endless provocations and oppressions from the State of Israel on the Palestinians. So one expects what's called lone wolf attacks, because also the Palestinian Authority works to suppress organized resistance. And when you have peaceful resistance becoming very difficult or impossible, that means that people resort to violence. So Palestinians, some individual Palestinians, take it upon themselves to resist. And this young man who killed three Israelis in Dusseldorf Street in Tel Aviv is one such person.
All right, Saad Nim, so obviously there's some, it's a state of people being frightened in Israel, looking at the statements from the Israeli Army Chief of Staff. It's quite telling, who says, "We suffered a defeat and the perpetrator escaped the scene easily." So that shows how security failed. Then the security of settlers has been damaged. This situation will continue for a while. And then finally saying that this has created fear among Israelis who now dread walking the streets. So pretty big impact, this operation, resistance operation that took place in Tel Aviv, don't you think?
Yes, indeed. It's quite obvious that not only by the war minister and the chief of staff, but also the Hebrew media generally today and yesterday, it was all over the issue. And they were talking about this huge failure, not only of what happened on Thursday night, but also the last, 10 days, if you like, with the many operations that's going on in Beni Brak, near to Tel Aviv, in Lechdera, and in also in other areas around in inside the Zionist entity. So what's going on in reality that Israel cannot stop this kind of operations, and they admit that this is something for them is really puzzling, because we are talking about individuals who are, doing that from their own side, and there is no any indication, in spite of the coordination with the Palestinian Authority, they cannot even expect and predict these kind of operations. And that's why they have this kind of fear about, the failure of the security system in Israel in such a way that anyone could come in, and it's for the first time that they installed roadblocks inside Israel itself on the roads leading to Tel Aviv and other areas. Now the Israeli, not only us, they have to stop at the roadblocks, which means that they are really in a state of fear, in a state of insecurity, and they feel that they can't, do these things like before. Usually the Israeli are so proud of their security system, and it's like, one of a kind. But apparently these last few days have proven without any doubt that the Israeli security system is not that kind of superior kind of security system, but it has its own flaws as well. And these kind of operations, they couldn't even stop. And we expect that they will see even more in the coming few days of such operations.
Mazen Kumseya, we have to talk about the reactions coming through on this. And the one that stands out is first how the U.S. and the EU ambassadors to Israel, as well as the EU and UN Middle East peace envoys, they've all come out condemning the attack. And even when you look on online social media, it's an uproar that you see based on people saying, oh, my God, people in Tel Aviv, Israelis were killed in Tel Aviv. And yet when you have Palestinians being killed, you don't hear anything condemning Israeli security forces for what they have done. Doesn't that spell double standard in the way that this topic is approached?
Indeed, there is some challenge to the public relations aspect of the Palestinian Authority and what it's trying to do. It's trying to stay viable in the sense that it's dependent on the largesse of the Western donors, Europeans primarily, and also trying to satisfy Israel, which is a de facto sovereign entity over the West Bank and Gaza. So the Palestinian Authority tries to bridge a gap, so to speak, and try to be balanced and diplomatic and satisfy the needs from the Western world. Of course, that makes them problematic in the eyes of the Palestinian public. And most of the Palestinian public actually recognizes that such activities, including armed resistance and nonviolent resistance, are natural response to colonization and occupation. So standing against the public in this matter is not helpful to the Palestinian Authority, and it's not helpful to, I mean, your guest mentioned security failure. I would say there's also a diplomatic failure and a political failure of the State of Israel at containing the Palestinians and containing the Palestinian Authority. Eventually, Palestinian Authority will fold out of its own weight.
Well, of course, we're looking at Saad Nimr, how Palestinians are being violated almost on a daily basis, if not on a daily basis. Hamas has come out and said the continuing terrorism of the occupation and its crimes attempts to Judaize East Al-Quds and to perform sacrifices at the Al-Aqsa Mosque to build its so-called temple. And he goes on to say more things, but basically citing that as reasons. But these reasons have been there. Why has there been such an increase in the past weeks leading up to Ramadan and then now over to we're a week into it?
Oh, yes, definitely. The sensitivity of Ramadan, and usually the Palestinians during Ramadan, they would usually go to Jerusalem and they will stay there overnight in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The prayers and Taraweeh and the rituals, which is, you know, bring them closer to their religion. So it's usually a yearly event. But this year, it was so clear of the incursions done by the settlers against the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and especially this guy Ben-Gvir, as well as the government, who are allowing the settlers to have their incursions during Ramadan, and their statement that we are going to enlarge the scale of the incursions to the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan. And that was a kind of a challenge to the Palestinians more than anything else. Plus, in the last, you know, let me say, last few months, there was a huge escalation by the settlers all over the West Bank against the Palestinians, whether it's, you know, by land grabbing and building settlements, enlarging existing settlements, confiscating more and more land, and especially in the Jordan Valley, in addition to the settlers who became really, really very violent against the Palestinians, standing on the streets and stoning the Palestinian cars, injuring Palestinians. And the Israeli army is just, you know, watching them. So there was a kind of an encouragement by this Israeli government to these settlers to do whatever they want, including the incursions on Jerusalem, in Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. That is a very sensitive issue, especially in Ramadan for the Palestinians. And everyone was expecting something happening. And I would remember that more than 10 days or 15 days, we were talking about that, and we were saying that we are expecting more violence coming in the few days to come in Ramadan because of the Israeli measures. Israel is taking, should take the full responsibility of the Palestinian reaction because they did not even stop or even try to stop. Instead, they have this meeting in Negev Desert with some Arab foreign ministers trying to influence Jordan and the Palestinian Authority to calm down during, okay, the Palestinians are saying officially, we want to calm down. How about you? What about the Israelis? They didn't calm down at all. And they were, you know, encouraging the settlers who said that we are going to increase our entrance to the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan. So they were, you know, aggravating the Palestinians.
Well, you talk about this meeting that were held with the foreign ministers of the Negev Desert. So I have to ask you, Mazen Gumsaya, your reaction to that. I mean, this normalization that has taken place is what's transpiring, and action is taking on that front instead of moving towards what was one day called a so-called peace talks between Palestinians and Israelis, the name that was under Trump, which he obviously did not live up to that, nor have any other previous U.S. presidents. When you talked about the diplomatic front there, Mazen Gumsaya, what do you think about this meeting that took place at the Negev Desert?
Well, this is not normalization. It's collusion and collaboration that has been going on for decades under the table. It's just the only difference that happened in the Trump era was that the U.S. Pushed publicly those Arab regimes to do it above the table and show their faces, basically. So that's the only difference is cosmetic. I mean, it's psychologically important that you have these Arab leaders meeting publicly. And in the stolen Negev, as we know, the Negev objected to a campaign of ethnic cleansing. Some villages and towns there have been destroyed more than once. Al-Araqib was destroyed more than 200 times and rebuilt. And so to happen in the backyard of this catastrophe of the Naqab is itself horrific. But at the same time, I don't think it changes the dynamic. And it's the last gasp of a Zionist regime that's looking to look nice in front of the world. And it's not working, I think.
Okay. Let's take a look at international law when it comes to the way that Palestinians actually have resisted. And I'd like to ask you, Saad Nim, when it comes to international law, based on what it's enshrined, it says Palestinians do have a right to use armed resistance against the Israeli military occupation. But at the same time, Israel characterizes any and all resistance to its military occupation as terrorism. Why does Israel perceive it that way?
Yeah, this is a real irony, because what's going on, that the victim, which in this case we're supposed to protect our occupier. That's our role now, to protect our occupier. As far as the international law is concerned, Palestinians do have the right to resist the occupation, and there was in 1982 a resolution saying specifically for the Palestinians that they have the right to use any mean of resisting the occupation, regardless, including the armed struggle, any mean that they find it appropriate. So I think that the conduct of the Palestinian Authority on the international level, though they are trying to make all their petal now regarding the international community and in the UN and all the other organizations, but I think the the discourse that they are using is not the one that they should use. It's very weak, and it's just, you know, like being, look what's going in Ukraine with Russia. You are condemning there. You are supporting them there. You are not. This is not the way. We can't hold our people anymore. That's what they should say. We can't stop Hamas. We can't stop Jihad Islami. We can't stop anyone if you continue with your measures against the Palestinians. If you continue with these settlements and the settler activities, we can't hold our Palestinian people from doing all this. That should be, you know, the discourse of the Palestinians, what to talk about. We can't do that because, you know, we are playing the weak part. And even apparently we like that, or the Palestinian Authority, they like this kind of role, and they continue to play this kind of weak character in front of the international community, which is absolutely not acceptable by the Palestinian people. And that's why the Palestinian people on their own now, in the last 2 days, the encouragement by the Palestinian people in all cities in the West Bank particularly were huge to the operation. They were, you know, giving sweets in the streets, and they were like demonstrating in support. This today at Bir Zeit, our university, we had a huge rally by all the students, all together, all the factions, to stand with Jenin and what happened in Jenin this morning. So the people level is totally different from the Palestinian Authority level, who are talking to the international community.
All right. Yeah. Well, you talk about the words of encouragement. You also have, Mazen Kumsaya, what Hamas has said, another part of the statements that came out of Hamas, stating the continuing terrorism of the occupation and its crimes, attempts to Judea's Jerusalem, along with the fact that you have military aggressions against our people in Jenin should generate a massive intifada uprising against the Zionist occupiers. Given what we have seen transpire, this resistance operation in Tel Aviv, do you think that there's a possibility that this may lead to a third intifada were it to continue? This is for Mazen Kumsaya.
It's very hard to predict the future, of course, but we've had 14 uprisings. They come and go in waves. Every 10 years or so, we have an uprising on average. And it's a growth of the resistance in a way that becomes massive and involve large segments of society. We saw this in last May in the events that happened on both sides of the Green Line in the West Bank and Gaza, inside the Galilee and the Naqab and around the world with people rising up against the Zionist regime. I think eventually there will be an uprising. I can't predict exactly what will happen, but in terms of low-scale resistance, you would expect such things to continue and increase, especially during the holy month of Ramadan, when the assault on Islam and Muslims in the Middle East increased from the Zionist regime, and when the collaborationist regimes of United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Morocco, and even Saudi Arabia are doing what they are doing. People have to react. It's a law of physics. To every action, there's a reaction. So I think that's natural.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Thank you, though, for that. That's Mazen Kumsaya from Bethlehem, Palestinian scientist and author. And thank you, Saad Nimr from occupied Ramallah, professor of political science at Bir Zeit University. And we had our correspondent, Monica Ndil, at the top of the spotlight. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the Spotlight from Mikhail Vitavoy and the entire team.